because you were talking about 1938, even the preparation of the Fourth International Conference, many of the four of the organisers were murdered, including Leon Sedov, Trotsky's son, and of Ignatius Rice, who came over an officer in the GPU came over in 1937 to the Fourth International and was hunted down and murdered. Of all those Bolsheviks or Bolshevik Leninists were murdered in Spain and other countries, and above all in Russia, where basically I would say the biggest section of the international in the early 1930s was in Russia, although it wasn't organized. It was individual Trotskyists who had been with Trotsky in the early period, who had been expelled from the party, expelled from the jobs, who had been exiled in the early 1930s for their ideas. And they're the ones, if you like, who put up the enormous sacrifice, and they wouldn't capitulate, even from the point to the point that they were prepared to die for their ideas. And we have the example in 1937 of the Vorkuta, of the camp in the Arctic Circle, where the Trotskyists were taken in the most bitterest conditions, where they held a hunger strike for 100 days in order to fight together, where other people capitulated and so on to Stalinism. They never capitulated. They were prepared to go to their death, because what they represented was the cause of the international working class, of world revolution, which they would never betray. And that was that's what gave them that strength of character. You don't go to your death lightly, by Christ. But they knew they were doomed, but they would not bow their heads in shame. But on the contrary, when they were prepared, when they had been taken out to be shot, they sang the Internationale, they raised their fists to Comrade Trotsky and the world revolution, because they had that faith, they had that determination, they weren't going to be crushed, because of these ideas were the ideas of the world proletariat, of humanity in the future. And that is why they were prepared to make all the sacrifices you could think of, the humiliations and so on. And those who were shot in 1930s, these are this in Vorkuta, didn't have any trial. They were just exiled and shot. Even those who were brought before the Moscow trials between 1936 and 1938, many didn't get the trial because they wouldn't capitulate. They weren't prepared to sign the false confessions that Stalin demanded. And they were simply taken out and shot for their ideas. And again, it was only Trotsky on a world scale. The superhuman, if you like, dedication of this man, and it's not a question of a personification, but in many ways, he does personify our struggle. Because in 1936, in August, when the Moscow trials were started, this monstrous witch hunt trial, like going back to the Middle Ages, of forced confessions, not one shred of evidence was given. Only your own confession. And you confessed to what? These are people who are the leaders of the Russian Revolution, of Zinoviev, of Kamenev, of Bukharin, of Rykov, and all these people who, yes, had capitulated. It showed they had a bit of a weak character. It was only the Trotskyists that stood out. Nevertheless, these were the general staff of the October Revolution, of the Central Committee of Lenin in October 1917. And they were to write that they wanted to betray the revolution, bring back capitalism, were in league with the fascists, wanted to murder Stalin, murder the leadership, and bring back landlordism and capitalism. And they wrote these confessions. And they were charged with terrorism after the Kirov assassination in 1934. And they did it willingly, because they had been crushed, because they had been worn down. This generation, which had went through the most exalted period of world revolution and the crushing defeats, and it wore people down, as I'll quote it in a minute. Revolution is the greatest devourer of people, because of the enormous toil and the enormous energy and effort that is required. And over a period of time, you can be worn down. It's possible. And they were worn down. They were betrayed by Stalin. Zinoviev and Kamenev was personally brought before Stalin in 1936 and told if they did this, they were doing it on the, to save the revolution. They had to sign this, these documents to save the revolution against imperialist intervention and also to save their own life, their own skins and the family's lives. Do it. And they were broken men, they did it. And then they were taken out 24 hours later and shot. That Stalin just laughed. As if you remember the writings where Lenin warned Trotsky in 1922, I believe it was. He said, whatever you do over the Georgia question and so on in the Central Committee, don't make a compromise with Stalin. Don't make a compromise with Stalin, said Lenin, because he will make a rotten compromise and he will betray you. That's what he, and that's exactly what Stalin did in 36 to these individuals, a rotten compromise which he betrayed and shot them all. Because then became one of defense of the privileges of the bureaucracy, and anybody who was linked to the October Revolution was a danger. And the other factor was, by the way, that Trotsky didn't let out publicly at that time. It was only where the archives were opened in 1980 that it was discovered that they were actually trying to put together that in 1932, Zinoviev and Kamenev, who had been broken people, realized because the economic situation within Russia at that time, you had the five-year plans, which had been introduced in 4 years, the mass collectivization, the brutality, the economic chaos that was being created, was giving rise to enormous discontent within society. And that affected the opposition. Even Zinoviev and Kamenev and others like that, they raised the idea of rebuilding the opposition. Because as you would recall, in 1927, it was a joint opposition. That Zinoviev and Kamenev, who had been with Stalin in 1926 and supported him, broke with him because of socialism in one country in particular, and went over to Trotsky and formed a united opposition in 1927. That was the main platform. But that disintegrated after they were expelled. The Zinovievists capitulated to Stalin. Said they were wrong, they had to go back, and so on and so forth. But even on the basis of events, there was certainly a revival of the idea of whether, look, Stalin's leading us to an absolute disaster. We should try and develop an opposition, even with the Trotskyists and so on and so forth. And Trotsky was in touch with them through various intermediaries. And it's quite possible that Stalin got to hear in 1933 about this possible revival and therefore decided to act. It's also the fact that the revolution, you know, in France in 1936, the sit-in in strikes, the Spanish Revolution developing, and all those were very dangerous situations for the bureaucracy because of one victory internationally would have led to the revival of the working class in Russia, and therefore the revival of opposition ideas. After all, the main idea of the opposition, which was even carried to the May Day, to the October celebrations in 1928 in Moscow, carry out Lenin Testament, big banners in Moscow, led by opposition. In other words, remove Stalin. That was Lenin's position. His testament was to remove Stalin as the general secretary and put someone else in there who was more honest, more dedicated, and so on. And he was an intriguer. But that was because of the links, because Kamenev and Zinoviev wanted to be the big shots and didn't want Trotsky to be to take over from Lenin, that they wanted to do it. They entered into a pact with Stalin to keep that quiet and all the rest of it. And everything began to, once you enter the slippery slope, then you can't get off it very easily. Once you make one compromise and make another and so on and so forth, you go down that slippery slope. But to go back, I thought, in relation to this discussion, I would like to go through the writings of Trotsky. And I started in 1929 and finished with 1929 because he was so rich, so thorough. I thought, well, I won't have enough time to go through the writings to prepare anything for this particular Central Committee. But I would like to give a bit of a flavour of Trotsky's attitude. And I'd like to quote, because I don't think that this material is necessarily available to all comments, and it should be, and I intend to write something on this and try and get as much of this flavour of Trotsky's struggle of sacrifice in developing the early ranks of the international left opposition in preparation for the founding of the Fourth International. If you just bear with me, I'll just read a few passages. It just gives you an idea. You can apply it and so on and so forth. But he was quite sharp, as you can imagine, this time. He was messing about. Is this about the task of the American opposition, written in 1929. There is nothing more disgusting and dangerous in revolutionary activity than a petty bourgeois dilettantism, a conservative, self-satisfied and incapacity of sacrifice in the name of great ideas. The advanced workers must firmly adopt one simple but invariable rule. Those leaders or candidates for leadership who in peaceful times and everyday times are incapable of sacrificing their time, their talent and their money to the cause of communism are most likely in a revolutionary period to turn traitor or to turn up in the camp of those who wait to see on which side the victory lies. If elements of this kind are at the head of the party, they will undoubtedly bring it to a disaster when the great test comes. Of course, the opposition, that is the Bolshevik-Leninists, may have their fellow travellers who, without devoting themselves wholly to the revolution, offer this or that service to the cause of communism. It certainly would be wrong not to make use of them. They can make a significant contribution to the work. But fellow travellers, even the most honest and serious, should make no pretense to leadership. The leaders must be bound in all their daily work with those they lead. Their work must proceed before the eyes of the rank and file, no matter how few the ranks may be at a given moment. We must steer a course to the young workers who desire to understand and to fight and is capable of enthusiasm and self-sacrifice. These are the people from whom we must attract and educate the genuine cadres of the party and the proletariat. Every member of the opposition should be obliged to have under guidance several young workers, youth from 14 to 15 years of age, and older, to remain in continual contact with them, to help them in their education, to train them in questions of scientific socialism, and systematically introduce them into revolutionary politics of the proletarian vanguard. Oppositionists, who are themselves unprepared for such work, should entrust the young comrades they have recruited to a more developed and experienced comrades. We don't want those who are afraid of rough work. The profession of a revolutionary Bolshevik imposes obligations. The first of these obligations is to win over the proletarian youth, to clear the road to its most oppressed and neglected strata. They stand first under our banner. The trade union bureaucrats, like the bureaucrats of pseudo-communism, live in an atmosphere of aristocratic prejudices of the upper strata of the workers. It would be tragic if the oppositionists were infected even in the slightest degree with these qualities. We must not only reject and condemn these prejudices, we must burn them out of our consciousness to the last trace. We must find the road to the most unprivileged and downtrodden strata of the proletariat, beginning with the Negroes in the United States, whom capitalist society has converted into pariahs, and who must learn to see in us their brothers. And this depends entirely on our energy and our devotion to the work. That gives you a bit of a flavour on what Trotsky was. This was a letter to the American leadership, the strongest section of the international at that particular time. He makes other observations which I think are worth reviewing. The revolution is a mighty devourer of people, he says. Of the older generation, there is an enormous percentage of desolate souls among the ruling majority. That's obviously of the Stalinists. and no small percentage among the oppositionists. The reaction is in full swing in the party and the Comintern, reflecting the general shift of class forces on a world scale. In such circumstances, withdrawals and capitulations inevitably become the norm. Bolshevism from 1907 to 1910 and again from 1914 to 1917 experience a whole series of such departures, splits, groups, individual capitulations. Only by way of self-cleansing, of self-clarification, was it able to grow and strengthen itself for the October Revolution. We are not in the least frightened by the withdrawals of comrades, even those with the most respective names. By example of their waverings, we will teach the steadfastness to the youth. It is clear that before us is a perspective of prolonged struggle and educational work. It will be necessary to renew our cadres. Let those who do not measure up to the work withdraw. After drifting and hesitating, some will come back to us. In the interval, we shall become stronger. We must educate a new generation in the spirit of steadfast Bolshevik implacability, along with work amongst the masses on the basis of our platform. We must deepen educational activity amongst the youth without being afraid to exert ourselves even for a single individual. We need to deepen international work on an international scale. Every serious Bolshevik must have around him some young people he will initiate day by day into the sphere of fundamental problems of Marxism and the International Revolution. He then takes various questions. The book's falling abroad, as you can see. There should be no illusions, says Trotsky. Revolutionary Marxists have been, once again, and not for the first time, and probably not for the last time, driven into a position of an international propaganda society, such as ourselves. By the very nature of things, such a situation involves certain elements of sectarianism which can be overcome only gradually. You seem to be frightened by the smallness of your numbers. That is, of course, unpleasant. It is, of course, best to have an organization numbering millions. But where are we, the vanguard of the vanguard, to obtain organizations of millions? The day after the world revolution has suffered catastrophic defeats in the most important countries, defeats produced by a mentioned leadership that hides behind a false mask of Bolshevism. Where? We are passing through a period of colossal reaction, this is the early 1930s, following the revolutionary years of 1917 to 1923. On a new and higher historical stage, we, revolutionary Marxists, find ourselves thrown back into a position of a small and persecuted minority, almost as at the beginning of the imperialist war. As all of history demonstrates, beginning with the First International, such regressions are unavoidable. Our advantage over our predecessors lies in the fact that the situation today is more mature and that we ourselves are more mature, in inverted commas, for we stand on the shoulders of Marx and Lenin and others. We shall capitalize on our advantage only if we are able to entice the greatest ideological irreconcilability, fiercer even than Lenin's irreconcilability, at the outbreak of war. The greatest honor for a genuine revolutionist today is to remain a, in inverted commas, sectarian of revolutionary Marxism in the eyes of the Philistines, the whimperers, and the superficial thinkers. Let me repeat, today we are once again only an international propaganda society. In this, the slightest reason for pessimism, despite the fact that behind us is the greatest historical mounting of the October Revolution, there is no need. Or more accurately, precisely because of this great historical mounting lies behind us, I have no doubt that the development of the new chapter of the proletarian revolution will trace its generality back to our little sectarian group. It goes on about sacrifice, how revolutions are formed, an article in 1929 in July. And here is the decisive point. To publish our documents in Russia, our friends have given all they had and sacrificed all that people could devote to the cause could sacrifice. In Paris, it was not a matter of doing so. To produce a weekly, it would have required altogether secondary and insignificant sacrifices. Sacrifices of time and money. You begin, you set a good example, and then you make demands on others because you have a right to make demands in the name of a common cause. That comrades who are capable of initiative and such personal sacrifice are revolutionaries, or can be, because it is in this way, Comrade Paz, that revolutionaries are formed. You can have revolutionaries both wise and ignorant, intelligent or mediocre, but you can't have revolutionaries who lack the willingness to smash obstacles, who lack devotion and the spirit of sacrifice. I was not mistaken. These young comrades, he's talking about a line of youth who came towards him, declared that they were completely prepared to give their time, their forces, their means for a weekly to mobilise others. So they are doing what they have promised. You are sabotaging their work, he's talking to La Paz, instead of helping them. Do you believe the task can be fulfilled by devoting it to the scraps of time left over from a busy law practice? He was having a go at La Paz. Do you believe you can manage the movement or even a weekly paper associated with the movement in passing, like some secondary task? I have a different idea of the revolutionary access. I believe that persons who manage a workers' paper, especially in a situation of heavy responsibilities like our own, ought to be occupied with this task alone. The person who belonged to the movement that is in Russia. I will not dwell upon the record of the Russian parties in times of illegal work, says Trotsky. The person who belonged to the movement, that is the Russian movement, belonged only with his material means, with his body and his soul. He identified openly with the cause he served. And it was by such a process of education that we were able to create fighters who became the many axes of the proletarian revolution. You must understand that the person who is the axis, that is, the leader or one of the leaders of the revolutionary movement, assumes the right to call upon workers to make the greatest sacrifices, including that of their lives. This right involves no less important responsibilities. Otherwise, every intelligent worker will ask themselves, if X, who calls me to the greatest sacrifices, keeps 4/5 or 2/3 of his time, not to assure my victory, but to assure his bourgeois existence, that shows that he does not have the confidence in the imminence of the coming revolution. And Trotsky says that worker would be right. Your letters, and above all, your political attitude that he's writing to La Paz, show me that communism is for you a sincere idea rather than a dominant conviction of your life. Perhaps last and not least, one aspect, a letter to an editorial board of La Lutte des Classes, the French Trotskyist paper. It is impossible to influence historical events with bare hands. An instrument is necessary. The basic instrument is the party, and at a given stage, it is the faction. When an aviator prepares to fly across an ocean, he must with tenfold care check nuts, bolts, screws and rudder. For him, nothing is too trifling. We are, after all, only beginning to build the mechanism for the future flight. Sloppiness here is essentially criminal. It goes on about the petty bourgeois. There was called the right tendencies, another danger, they're very acute at this given stage. I would call it the danger of petty bourgeois dilettantism. In Russia, the opposition is fighting under extreme conditions. which permit only genuine revolutionists to remain within its ranks. This cannot be said without reservations about Western Europe, particularly France, not only amongst the intellectuals, but also amongst the upper layer of workers. There are not a few elements who are willing to bear the title of the most extreme revolutionists, so long as it does not impose upon them any serious obligations. That is, so long as they are not obliged to sacrifice their time, their money, submit to discipline, endanger their habits and their comforts. And there is plenty more you could quote from Trotsky, because his whole life was to bring out the essence of Bolshevism, not only politically but theoretically, but also to create the raw material which could be the basis of Bolshevism. That is, the creation of cadres, of comrades who have a common bond politically and theoretically, and are prepared to make the sacrifices required at each stage in the development of the organisation. And therefore, we can say that the founding of the Fourth International was the height of Trotsky's work during the 1930s. It put down the banner, it put down the mark, it put down the tradition. Unfortunately, as we know, the leaders of the Fourth International weren't up to the task posed by history. That they didn't absorb the methods of Trotsky. They simply repeated the words of Trotsky without understanding Trotsky. And they weren't able to, therefore, adjust to the new situation that had arisen, particularly after the Second World War. And that those mistakes weren't recognised. They were compounded and recompounded and compounded more. Until the very, as I went, go back to the original remarks I made, an international is first and foremost theory, perspectives, programme and methods. And if you destroy those particular things, or twist them, or distort them, or revise them, then you will destroy the essence of what you're building. And those so-called leaders of the Fourth International after the war basically trampled on the basic principles of Trotskyism, of Bolshevism, of the International itself, revised them, changed it, adapted them above all to the pressures of society, the pressures of bourgeois public opinion, the pressures of Stalinism, and so on and so forth. The only individual who stood out at that time, the only organisation that stood out at that time, you could say, first and foremost, was the Workers' International League in Britain, was the Revolutionary Communist Party, and particularly the role of Comrade Ted Grant, who was indispensable, who provided the backbone of that tradition at that point in time. And he was able, given his commitment, to withstand an enormous amount of pressures. Not only the breakup of the RCP, and the reduced to a tiny handful, as Trotsky was. He didn't worry about that. He carried on. He got up and carried on and tried to defend those basic principles. And on the basis of that, he built and developed. Unfortunately, we knew that the movement was derailed in 1992 by the ultra-leftism of the majority leadership that existed there at that time, who again had tried to find a new way out, you know, some new thing, which didn't exist. It was the old cooked-up ideas of ultra-leftism of the past, in essence. And our struggle was to defend the fundamental principles. However, we could also say, 15 years after the event, 16 years after the event, yes, we did also bring towards us individuals who weren't fighting the same fight as ourselves. Just as Trotsky complained at that time in 1930, the same situation. People who were against the old regime, the old, you know, as if that was the end of it, but had thrown out the baby with the bathwater, because they wanted to reject even, they wanted to reject even the principles on which we were standing. And this, even the misconceptions, and then perhaps a bit of miseducation, over or miseducation, about the mass organisations. It wasn't simply a question of remaining static, waiting on events in the mass organisations. On the contrary, all we knew was the vital importance of the mass organisations in the building of the tendency. A propaganda group, you can build a propaganda group. No problem with that. A couple of hundred, even a couple of thousand is possible. You know, put in a few, you know, leaflets to the university, leaflets out here, you can build it. But there's a different proposition to build a mass revolutionary movement. Not of a couple of those, but tens, hundreds of thousands. And that requires a correct understanding and orientation to the mass organizations. And that's what we understand, which are basically the fundamental the ideas Marx, Engels, Lenin and Trotsky, who had that similar conception. We've developed it, we've sharpened it, we've enriched Marxism, thanks to Comrade Ted in particular. In a modest way, we've done that. And we don't treat, but the danger is always of not appreciating the method of seeing some, getting a bit of a fetish over something. And above all, you have to be flexible. Flexibility is key. Bolshevism, in fact, it's not all this. As Trotsky said, actually, it's 10% intransigence. It's 90% trying to connect your ideas with the real movement at that particular stage. You know, and it's a real rich history as far as that is concerned, where we understand we don't sit in the mass organizations, we do fundamentally open work. It's long-term work in the mass organizations, but with the rider, that obviously we're looking for at this point in juncture for the individuals, ones and twos, which are not in the mass organization fundamentally. Of course, we work in the trade unions, but we have to look outside to other layers, which can be one, mainly at this stage, young people in particular. They're also in the trade unions. You'll also find people who are now beginning to open up to our ideas. But that's the whole basis. Another absolute flexibility, but understanding that in the long term, the mass organizations are going to be decisive. But how many we carry, what kind of force we can use to influence those events in the future depends on the tactics and the approach we have today. Because if, as is explained before, if we go there with a handful, well, you make a little bit of a ripple on the sidelines. If you go there with a sizable force, you can make an impression and actually change certain facts. You can become a more factor in the situation as we were in the past. And therefore, you know, we have to look, in my opinion, yes, take this opportunity. That's all it is. A commemoration is only an opportunity to look back a bit more, you know, to raise our head up from the struggles we're doing on a day-to-day basis and so on in the union field, the youth field, all the aspects, and to take and appraise things in a bit of a broader way. Look at our development, where we come from and where we are going, and to have a sense of history, have a sense of responsibility, which is also a sense of enthusiasm as to what the possibilities hold in the future for us. And but yes, it will mean big sacrifice for the working class, not only ourselves. Big sacrifices. But we are prepared to shoulder those sacrifices because of the goal that exists in front of us. And this is what we must imbue our comrades, the younger comrades and the older comrades, to rekindle that spirit, to rekindle those ideas that allows us not only to march on, but march on proudly, to work as hard as we can for the building of the organisation. You attach. It is to build the organisation. But you have to realise what that is, how to do it, and to apply yourselves and apply others with energy, elan, and a sense of achievement. Because that's what Trotsky offers you. Not only the ideas, the fundamentals, but a great inspiration of what these pioneers, our pioneers, did to hand down to us these ideas. And we take those ideas in a precious way and apply them and make sure that we in a modest way perhaps, meet up to our responsibilities of history and the colossal sacrifices and dedication that has gone on in the past. On that basis, we will build a movement, not only in Britain, but internationally. And as a PS, for those who hadn't heard it yesterday, I had an email last week, a few days ago, which said, just looking at the television, from a comrade in Venezuela, from Caracas, Hugo Chavez was speaking live from a meeting of the United Socialist Party, where he took out Alan's book and quoted Alan's book on Bolshevism, which again is quite an amazing situation. How did that happen? The power of ideas. power of ideas. And we must appreciate that fact in our everyday work. And on that basis, we salute the founders of the Fourth International, and we carry forward that tradition ourselves.